Hello, this is Chris Long with the ninth episode of The Forgotten by David Baldacci. There have been a lot of killings in the town of Paradise, Florida, but things seem to be starting to come together, and it involves something to do with slave trade. And Agent Puller, the inspector from the Army, is starting to find out one of the reasons that his aunt was murdered. Chapter 66. Taking something or bringing something. Jane Ryan screamed and jumped backward as the light came on. Puller stood there, staring directly at her. When Ryan turned to run, she pitched headlong into Carson, who stepped into the other doorway. Ryan bounced off Carson, but before she could move again, Puller had her wrist clamped with his hand. She didn't even try to tug herself free, understanding that that was impossible. "What are you doing here?" asked Puller. "I could ask you the same thing. I have permission to be here. Mr. Mason gave me this." She held up a key. "Why would Mason give you a key to his office? Why is that any of your business?" "I saw you leaving Cookie's house last night," said Puller, "and then I found Cookie lying in the bottom of his bathtub." Puller watched her intently for any reaction to this. "Cookie's dead? You're not a very good poker player, Jane. You know he was dead. And the police are looking for you. Where have you been hiding out?"
"I haven't been hiding. Why would I hide? Why would I hurt Cookie? I liked him."
With his free hand, Puller slipped the stapled piece of paper from his pocket. "Inventory list of my aunt's personal possessions. Mason gave it to me. The only problem is it doesn't list all of my aunt's jewelry. There are two rings, three sets of earrings, and a necklace missing. All look pretty valuable, and a dozen old gold coins are also missing from a coin book she had."
"I wouldn't know anything about that."
"Actually, you know everything about it. Those pieces were in your bag when I ran into you at my aunt's house. I had told Mason that I was going to my aunt's house in the morning, but then I changed my mind and went that night. He had sent you to the house to get the jewelry and coins before I could have a chance to go through her things. You have already inventoried the items, and then Mason had decided which ones he wanted you to rip off and change the real inventory list to reflect those subtractions. But you had to get them out before I saw them, or so he thought. The fact is, I had already seen my aunt's jewelry and coins before you got to the house, only he didn't know that. When I went back to check later, those items were gone. You took them. You did the same thing to Cookie. You took some of his watches. I found the inventory list for Cookie's property in the file here. It didn't list the watches that were missing, and I know they were missing because Cookie showed me his collection. You and Mason have a nice scam going. You get inside the houses of elderly people that Mason represents and find out what their valuables are. Then, when they die, you take them, and Mason alters the inventory list accordingly. Fences the items, and the poor heirs aren't any the wiser. Then Mason can afford his Aston Martin and trips around the world, and I'm betting you're damn well paid for your part." Ryan's face had been growing paler with each word spoken by Puller. Carson added, "And maybe you help your targets into the hereafter. You kill Cookie, and that way you get his property faster."
"I didn't kill Cookie."
"But you were in his house." Puller stared at her bag. "Open it."
"What?"
"Open your bag." "You have no right to." Puller grabbed the bag and opened it. Wrapped in a silk scarf were four of Cookie's watches. "Say goodbye to your life, Jane." Ryan was crying.
"I didn't kill him. I swear to God I didn't. Tell the police that. You just walked into his house, took his property that you could only take after he was dead, and he was coincidentally dead upstairs in the bath. It might give the jury a nice laugh before they sentence you to prison for the rest of your life."
"Mason told me to go there and get the watches, so I did."
"He told you to do that?"
"Yes."
"Didn't you wonder how that was possible with Cookie still being alive?"
"Okay, look. He told me that Cookie was dead. And how did he know that?"
"I don't know. Mason kills him for some reason,
then orders her up to get the stuff.
Why wouldn't Griff just snag the watches if he was already there?"
"So it's Griff now and not Mr. Mason?" Puller looked at her and shook his head wearily.
"And the answer is because he wanted you to take the stuff, not him. That would put you at the scene of the crime. As soon as you found out Cookie was dead, you'd get suspicious. And you're not going to say anything because you were in the house, too. He set you up."
"That son of a gun!"
snarled Ryan, who was no longer crying. But why would he kill Cookie? Asked Carson. Puller put his hand on Ryan's shoulder and gripped. Any ideas on that?
No, he never mentioned anything to me about it. He would have no reason to kill Cookie.
When did he call you to go over to Cookie's?
Last night. I was in the area, so only took me a few minutes to get there.
Would Mason have been at Cookie's?
I don't know. Maybe he went over for a drink or to get some baked goodies.
An old man is dead. Did you have anything to do with my aunt's death?
I swear I didn't.
Why don't I believe you?
I'm telling the truth.
Well, the jury will determine that. Now, where is that guy? Asked Paula.
I don't know.
Not good enough. Try again.
Is he at home?
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
He has another place he goes to. It's more isolated.
Why does he want isolation?
He just does sometimes. Does it have to do with the photos of kids he has in his wallet?
Ryan looked up at him, stunned.
What are you talking about? The guy's a pedophile?
Snap Carson, where is this place? Asked Polo sharply.
It's north of here, up near the bay. Nothing else really around it.
You have the address?
Yes.
Why, do you like kids, too?
No, of course not, shouted Ryan, and she started to cry again.
Puller squeezed her shoulder once more and cupped her chin and directed her gaze right at him.
We're going to give you a chance to make amends, Jane, but you only get one shot. You blow this, it's all over. Do you understand?
She looked back at him, the fear etched in her face.
I understand.
Chapter 67. Mako put his phone away after making the call. It was the longest he had ever been on the phone. The man on the other end was critical to the success of Mako's task. The man knew this, and Mako knew this. It was give and take. What the man wanted, Mako would have to give him if he wanted to succeed, and he had never wanted anything more in his life. You will have to prove that to me, Mako, the man had said. Words are available to anyone with a mouth and half a brain.
It will be done, Mako had told him. Now he just had to figure out how. He left his room at the Sierra and walked to a diner nearby. He ate lightly for such a massive person. He had never eaten very much for the simple reason that he never had much available to eat. Over the years, one's stomach and appetite withered, but it was partly the hunger that drove him, kept him on edge. Complacency and comfort were not words that he accepted or even understood. He drank copious amounts of water, though. The physical ordeal of swimming through the gulf still lingered. He felt he would never get enough liquid inside him. He paid for the meal with some of the dollars he'd earned keeping Peter Lambert's property pristine. He considered it blood money. Anything that helped the man was blood money in Mako's mind. He looked around the small diner and was not unduly surprised to see two uniformed police officers eating their meals. They sat near the door, a man and a woman. The man was short and burly with a shaved head. The woman was taller with an athletic build and blonde hair. They were having an intense conversation. The man looked upset. The woman looked consoling. It seemed to be a woman's lot in life to ease the ridiculous anger of men, thought Mako. As he rose to leave, both officers' gazes rose to meet him. He nodded, attempted to smile, and walked out. He did not much care for the police. For him, they were as much an adversary as his actual one. They were bound to uphold the law. There was no law that would ever touch Peter Lambert or Stephen Rogers. They were too clever and too dangerous by half of anything as important as laws to bother them. They had to be punished in other more straightforward ways. He walked down the street, trickles of sweat winding down his shoulders and broad back. He opted to take a stroll on the beach to attempt to catch an ocean breeze before he headed back to the little oven that was his room. He trudged across the sand, oblivious to the other beachcombers, but his antenna was still on high alert, or so he thought. Mako? He turned, but he already knew who the speaker was. Chrissy Murdoch stood there, sandals in hand. She had on a white sundress, and the wind whipped it around her long legs. Mako simply stood there, neither advancing nor retreating. She walked toward him, looked up at him. Why are you here? He asked. I was just walking on the beach and saw you.
Mr. Lambert has a private beach, nicer than this one.
I suppose he does. I'm surprised you know that, though.
Enjoy your walk. He turned to walk back to the Sierra. Every warning bell he possessed was clanging so hard he felt almost deafened. Mako. He stopped but did not turn back around. He felt her hand on his arm. Still, he didn't look at her. I understand that you are asking about the whereabouts of my bedroom. The question was not the one he had been expecting. She stood in front of him. Was there a reason for your inquiry beyond the obvious one? What is the obvious one? Sex, of course. He did not smile back. He had no reason to smile. She was playing an odd sort of game with him. But, of course, it wasn't a game at all. It was never a game when people died. I doubt that the guards would let me into the main house. Well, we're not at the main house right now, are we? Where are you staying? He turned and trudged off down the sand. She followed her feet, making springy steps over the sand. He stopped so abruptly that she almost bumped into him. He turned, looked down at her. So what is the non-obvious reason? She didn't seem surprised by the question. Since it's not obvious, I'm not really sure. You treat everything so casually. Your English is much better in town. I learned quickly. About my bedroom? Who told you I was making inquiries? I like being on the top floor. It gives one some interesting perspectives. On what? Lots of things. Why are you at Lambert's? I'm staying with Mr. Winthrop. The man who doesn't care if another man screws you? There are lots of men like that, Mako. I am not like that. No, I would imagine you wouldn't be. She slipped her sandals back on. The sand is so hot at this hour, so where are you staying? Why do you want to know? I like to know things. He turned and walked off. I can find out, you know, on my own. He stopped and turned back as she drew closer. What do you want? Maybe the same thing you want. How would you know what I want? Perhaps you're not as subtle as you think you are. Mako stared right through her. The thing is, Mako, I'm not sure we can both get what we want. Only one of us can. Only one of us can, he repeated. He turned and walked off. This time she did not follow him. He did not look back. Mako was thinking only one thing. I will have to kill her after all. Chapter 68. Jane, what the hell are you doing here? Griffin Mason stared back at Ryan as she stood on the front stoop of his cottage near Chukwuepi Bay. He was dressed in a robe and his hair was disheveled. Actually, it's a threesome, said Pulla, as he appeared on the right of Ryan while Carson appeared on the left of the woman. Mason paled as he looked at the pair. Pulla said, we need to come in and talk. This isn't a good time. Before he could look back, he was being propelled into the house by a hard shove from Pulla. His robe flew open, revealing his naked body. I didn't say it was a request, said Pulla as he stood over Mason, who had ended up on his back on the floor. Where are they? Where is who? Pulla grabbed him by his shoulders and jerked him to his feet. The kids, where are they? What kids? Diego and Mateo. Carson glanced sharply at him. Pulla eyed her. It occurred to me on the way over, this jerk-off can afford $1,000 to buy a kid. They all heard a noise from the next room. Pulla raced to the door and threw it open. Mason shouted, damn it, you can't go in there. The hell I can't. He froze in the doorway as the others joined him. They all stared into the room, a bedroom. Someone was on the bed. It was not Diego or Mateo. It was Isabel, and she was naked. She barely had time to lift the sheet to cover her body. Isabel? She stared back at him, her face a ball of anger. What the hell is going on, Griff? She explained, looking over at Mason. Mason grabbed Pulla by the arm and tried to jerk him around, but Pulla was so big and strong that Mason merely ended up knocking himself off balance and falling to the floor. He jumped back up and screamed, I am going to sue your ass off. Pulla turned to him. What is she doing up here? That is none of your business, yelled an apoplectic Mason. It is my business. He looked at Isabel. Are you here voluntarily? Of course I am. Now get your ass out of here, yelled Mason. And you better damn well lawyer up. I'm going to own your military pension and every other asset you have, including your aunt's house. What about the photos of kids in your wallet, the black kid and the Asian? How did you know about them? Who are they? They're my kids. What? My ex and I adopted them years ago. They're both grown now. But I carry their pictures in my wallet from when they were kids. Not that it's any of your damn business. Isabel, how old are you? 16, she replied automatically. Isabel, the truth, it's something we can find out easily, but it'll be better coming from you.
I'm almost 16 in a year and a half.
Bulla looked at Mason in disgust.
You're in bed with a 14-year-old?
She told me she was 16. Check out her rack. She looks 18.
How much is he paying you?
I'm not paying her anything. This is not a prostitution thing.
Right. She's just up here screwing an old fat guy because it's so much cooler than doing the young bucks.
He just gives me things, said Isabel.
Like what? Said Carson.
Don't say anything, Isabel. They're just trying to trick you. I'm calling my lawyer.
Stat rape is stat rape, Mason noted Puller. Not much of a defense to look.
Look, we can work this out. It was just a misunderstanding. It doesn't matter. You're going down either way, stat rape or not.
What? Said Mason, looking confused.
We busted your scam.
What scam?
Puller looked at Ryan, and Ryan looked at Mason.
Puller said, I caught her with the stolen goods. She ratted you out, and now we know an estate's lawyer can afford an Aston Martin. So maybe you better lawyer the hell up.
Mason stared at Puller for a few seconds and then lunged at Ryan.
You stupid girl!
His hands went around her neck and he was squeezing with all his strength. Puller ripped him off her and threw Mason back against the wall. Ryan slumped to the floor, gasping for breath, and looked terrified. Puller whipped Mason's hands behind his back and secured them with plastic cuffs.
Okay, we also now have your ass for assault and attempted murder. Thanks for the favor.
You jerk, screamed Mason again at the sobbing Ryan.
Yeah, we got it the first time, Carson said.
Puller grabbed Mason by the neck. And maybe you help your targets into the grave a little faster so you can cash in Griff.
Mason looked at him blankly.
What?
Cookie.
Floating in a bathtub. You were there. You told Ryan to get over there and take his most valuable watches. Only way that works is if he's dead.
I didn't kill him.
Yeah, right. And what about my aunt? What makes her do a header into the fountain? Hold her under?
I swear to God I didn't.
We know you were at Cookie's house, roared Paula.
Okay, I was there for a meeting. I found him dead.
Baloney.
He was. That's why I told Jane to get her ass over there. I wanted to get the watches out before anyone came to the house. Do you know how much they're worth?
Save it for your trial. Puller looked back at Isabel.
Get dressed. I'm taking you home. By the way, your Abdullah has been worried sick.
I have a life to lead. Where are Diego and Mateo?
I don't know.
Do you know they were missing?
She stared at him defiantly and then shrugged.
They'll probably come back.
Get dressed, he said quietly and shut the door.
As they hauled Mason and Ryan outside, Puller's phone buzzed. He looked at the text that had just come across. His jaw plunged.
Son of a gun.
What is it? Asked Carson as they loaded Ryan and Mason into the back of the Tahoe and slammed the door shut.
Puller stared across at her. Emmy finished the post on Cookie. He wasn't murdered. He died from a popped aneurysm.
Carson said, so Mason's not a killer, and he's not a pedophile. He's just a scum who steals from old people and beds underage girls.
Puller sighed and leaned on the top of the Tahoe.
So we're back to square one, with Diego and Mateo, too, added Carson.
With everything, actually, said Puller quietly. He glanced at his watch. It was 1:15, and he looked at the time something clicked in his brain. It had always been there, he supposed, but until that moment it had not registered.
Puller, what is it?
Puller didn't hear Carson. Part of him couldn't believe it. Part of him could, but he would have to make sure. He would have to make calls. He would have to dig. He would have to once more become the investigator. It was about time, he thought. It was about damn time.
Chapter 69. Mason and Ryan were in custody with the Paradise Police Department. Puller had given a full report to Bullock, who was burning the midnight oil. It had taken hours to fill him in on everything and then hours more to complete the paperwork. Justin, it seemed, was obsessed with paper. Bullock did not seem pleased to have one more thing added to his plate, but he had his people fill out the necessary reports and ordered Ryan and Mason into holding cells. Mason was screaming about suing the entire city of Paradise, but Ryan had signed a confession, and it was confirmed that Isabel was only 14, so the stat rape charge seemed solid. Isabel was released into her grandmother's care after confirming in writing the account of what had happened. Puller had also filled out a missing persons report on Diego and Mateo. He had told Bullock about the allegation that a man had paid $1,000 for them. Bullock's features had turned darker when he listened to this. Carson, who had been hovering in the background, said, "Do you have a problem with things like this in paradise?" "What do you mean?" "With people being bought like that," said Pollard. "Look, we have a large population of undocumented down here. Even with the reverse immigration because of the bad economy. If people are here illegally, it's hard to know if anyone's disappeared. Folks come and go. These are two little kids. They live with their grandmother." "I get that, Puller, but I don't have the manpower to put on every case of folks disappearing. Not even the big city departments can do that anymore. It's just the way things are." "Then things suck." "Okay, they suck. What do you want me to do about it?" "You're putting a lot of resources on the Lambert case. A bomb exploded there, but no one was hurt. It's different. It's only different because he has the biggest estate in paradise." Bullock rifled through some papers and didn't respond. "Any leads on the bomber?" "No." "What about Cookie?" "Not a homicide, you know that. Aneurysm popped. So if you were thinking there about it was a homicidal lunatic loose on Orion Street, and that person killed your aunt too, well, stop thinking it. Just because Cookie's death was from natural causes doesn't mean my aunt wasn't murdered. Puller, I appreciate you bagging Mason and Ryan, I really do. If the case holds against them, they're scum, who deserve to go away to prison. But what I will not appreciate is you running around town playing detective. I offered my service before, and you told me you might take me up on it. I said might, and I've decided not to. You're not part of this department. You're in the military. You have no authority here, and I have no authority over you. Things would get tricky real fast." "Okay, I guess I understand that. Thanks. Now, if you'll excuse me, I've got to process the paperwork." Puller and Carson left and walked out into a new day with the sun already well up into the sky and the heat and humidity feeling like a pitcher of warm beer poured on them. Carson stretched and worked a kink from her neck. "Well, I'm officially tired." "Yeah, no, going to bed at night does that to a person." He looked at its watch. "It's already 10:00. "We should catch some bunk time, John. Otherwise, we'll be no good for anything." Back in his room, with Sadie bedded down on a large beach towel in the corner, Puller showered, toweled off, slipped on a pair of boxers, and toppled backward on his bed. He wanted to go to sleep, but he couldn't, not yet. He rose and spent the next 2 hours burning up cell minutes. He found out a great deal of interesting information. All of it dovetailed nicely with what he had been thinking. And if he hadn't looked at his watch last night, he never would have thought of it. Sometimes the mind did work in mysterious ways. He had more calls to make and more digging to do, but now he lay back on the bed and fell instantly asleep. Hours later, the knock on his door surprised him. He rose, snaking his MLM out of his holster. "Yeah," he said, standing to the left of the door. "You can stand down. It's just your friendly neighborhood one star. You decent?" Puller opened the door and looked at Carson. She had on a clingy light blue sleeveless dress with a V-neckline and 2-inch heels. "What time is it?" 1700. "Damn, I must have really been asleep. I only felt like an hour of sack time. Can I come in?" He stopped back and let her pass. She smelled of ginger and lilacs. Her skin glowed. Her hair was swept back, highlighted by the sun. The dress stopped about mid-thigh. She sat on the bed and crossed her long legs as he closed the door. "I thought we could talk about the case and then think about dinner, unless you want to hook up with Officer Landry." She was gazing not at his face, but at a spot lower. Puller looked down and realized he was still in his boxes. "You must have a different definition of decent than I do, Puller." "I don't want to hook up with Officer Landry," he said curtly. "All I needed to know." She rose, stepped out of her heels, undid the clasp of the back of her dress, and it fell to the floor. She had nothing on underneath. "This must seem very forward of me. It actually seems just right." She rubbed her hand across his cheek. "I've learned from the army that when you want to take a position, you just have to go for it. Hesitation is for losers." She lay back on the bed and lifted up the covers. "I know you've been asleep a long time, but you want to crawl back in here? You won't be sleeping. That I can guarantee." They kissed lightly at first and then deeper, their fingers probing. He traced her lips with his fingers. "No words necessary." He lifted her up, her long legs immediately scissoring around his torso. He laid her back on the bed. There was a rim of sweat on her back that Pola flicked his hands over as he gripped her tightly. A familiar motion took over, growing more and more frantic as the fire inside each of them reached a point of no return. Her moans were becoming more rapid. She started to talk, telling him in his ear precisely what it was she wanted. A while later, Puller gave one last shudder and fell limp over Carson. She was gasping and trying to catch her breath and telling him how pleased she was at his performance. Together, they slowly moved down to lay flat on the bed side by side. That was truly unbelievable, John. It was, thought Pola, and he told her so. She turned, faced him, and kissed him, first on the cheek, then the lips, sliding her fingers up and down one side of his face. It had been a while for Pola. He worried whether he could bring the necessary level of passion. Apparently he had, and that made him feel both satisfied and relieved as he lay there next to her. He was still breathing hard, like he'd just completed the Army 2 mile in record time. "I don't do this sort of thing lightly, just so you know," she said. "You don't seem the type." "I'm not," she said firmly, propping herself up on one elbow. "I'm not either," he said. "Trust me, I know. You've been checking me out? Your record speaks for itself. Not a lot of room in there for personal time. You either. Simple story, chasing stars. So where do we go from here, big fellow?" Puller jerked up and stared at her. "I'm not looking for an engagement ring and a wedding date, Puller. I'm talking about eating. I'm starved." "Then how about we go eat?" She kissed him, ran her fingers along a part of his anatomy that made him shudder. She whispered in his ear, "Is that an order, soldier?" "With all due respect, ma'am, yes it is." Chapter 70. Their bellies full, Puller and Carson sat back from their empty place and studied each other. "You're looking at me as though our relationship has changed somehow," she said. "Hasn't it?" They were occupying the back corner of a restaurant. The hour was still early enough that the large dinner crowds had not come in yet. They had the place mostly to themselves. "Why, because we've slept together? I can't think of any other reason." "Was it that important for you? I guess it wasn't for you." "Don't be offended, John, but it is the 21st century. Like guys have for most all of history, girls just sometimes want it for no other reason than they want it." "Okay. Feeling used?" He looked at her, grinned back. "Turning the tables on the male psyche?" "About time, wouldn't you say? I'm a poor representative of the typical male. That's what I like about you. Take Landry, for instance. What about her? She's young and hot. She wants you in the sack. No leap of deduction there. But she's no doubt been hit on by every cop in the department. Probably has. And you think the DOD is any different? Come again? I've had my ass pinched by my share of one through four stars. At West Point, it was the same. Instructors and boneheaded plebes. Then out in the field with leaves and clusters, thinking it was okay what they said and did to a woman in the ranks. Hell, during my tours of combat in the Middle East, sometimes it seemed I was fighting a war on both flanks. Surprise you? The Army answer would be yes, it would surprise me. And your answer? You know my answer. It's not the same as the Army's. Propositioned, harassed, threatened, even assaulted. Welcome to this man's army, right? He sat forward, his hands making fists on top of the table. There are procedures for that, Julie. You don't have to take it. Like you said, it's the 21st century. Right. And part of this century looks like just like all the others. Men are still men, however much more enlightened they may be, or constrained by the threat of lawsuits, court-martial, wrecked careers, and aggravated wives. But they still pull their crap because they think they can get away with it. They always think that. And so you just took it? I didn't say that, she held up her fist. Sometimes it was this. Sometimes it was a knee to the nuts. Sometimes it was just a stare. And yeah, sometimes it was paperwork filed with careers torpedoed. But sometimes I didn't do or say anything. Sometimes I just walked away. You don't seem the type to just walk away. I had long-term plans, Pola. The Army wasn't just a lark for me. I wanted big things. I wanted to do big things. I wanted the star path. I have one. I want at least two more. So go along to get along? Not my idea of leadership. Leadership is a funny thing. The parameters keep changing. But one thing you can't compromise on is, can you look at yourself in the mirror the next day? I always could, no matter what happened. It wasn't my problem, it was theirs. They shouldn't be able to look in the mirror. They're the ones who couldn't control themselves. So where does that leave us? I didn't come down here to get you into bed. Well, maybe a part of me did. Now that we've done that, I can focus on what I really came down here for. Arana, to help you solve a case, what do we do next? I'm not used to generals asking me for direction. The best leaders let their people do what they do best. Your CID, I don't have a clue about investigating criminal acts. So again, what do we do next? The Staros. The Staros? The couple murdered on the beach. They knew my aunt. You think that's why they were killed? I'm thinking that the Staros were out a lot, sometimes walking, maybe sometimes driving. Driving like 5 miles out and five back? Maybe so. And they told your aunt what they saw, or thought they saw, or suspected. She wrote the letter to my old man, but she really wanted me to come down and look into things. She would have been able to tell me more, but she never got the chance. Pulla slipped the letter from his pocket and passed it over to Carson. She ran her gaze down it. Mysterious happenings in the night. People not what they seem. Something just not being right. Pretty cryptic stuff. My aunt was not given to overstating things. For her, those words might as well be screaming murder. Well, if you're right about her death, she was entirely justified in thinking so. But if the Staros are dead, how do we proceed? Son and daughter-in-law, they reported them missing. I'm hoping they can fill in some gaps. You ready? She smiled up at him and almost purred. After the sack time, I'm damn well ready for pretty much anything. Chapter 71. Mako chugged water from a gallon container and stared across at the big house. Everything about it was perfectly designed, perfectly placed. The shell was of amazing beauty. What lay underneath was not so beautiful. But then that was how the world often worked. He wiped his mouth, put a jug back on the truck, and picked up a rake. He trudged off to a path of lawn underneath some trees. In a side lawn, a large fountain poured water into a concrete catch basin. The perimeter of this secret garden was lined with lush plantings, wooden benches placed in nooks and crevices with cobblestone pavers underneath. Mako had worked this section of the estate before. He found it peaceful, meditative. He suspected this had been Mrs. Lambert's design. He did not think that Peter Lambert was capable of contemplating such a place of a serenity. As he rounded the corner and set to work with his rake, he was surprised to see that one of the garden seats was occupied. Chrissy Murdoch held a book in her hands, but she wasn't looking at it. She was staring off in the direction of the water that lay close enough that they could hear the rolling breakers. She wore pale green shorts, a white blouse, and tennis shoes with ankle socks. Her hair was pulled back and fixed in a tight braid. The sun filtered across her face through the branches of nearby trees. Mako watched her, momentarily caught up in both her beauty and her apparent melancholy. When she started and looked his way, he returned to his work, raking flower beds and setting the mulch back into neat, compact mounds. "It's a beautiful day, isn't it?" she said. "Every day in paradise is beautiful, isn't it? Don't we both know better than that?" He looked up, his large fingers gripping the handle of the rake. He said nothing, prompting her to speak again. "Have you thought about our encounter on the beach last night?" "Have you?" "I've thought of nothing but that. I've given it a little time in my mind. I think you have me confused with someone else." She rose, closed her book, and drifted over to him. "So you're simply a common laborer who maintains a rich man's property. I'm holding a rake. My shirt is slick with sweat. I ride in a truck. I live in a hole. Draw your own conclusions. But you are educated." "Educated or not, I have to make a living. This is not my country. One has to start from the bottom. It is the way with any country. Some start from the top. Those with connections or family wealth, I have neither, do you? I have my looks. I have a certain grace. I know which fork to hold. Small talk to make. I know an Italian wine from a French, a Monet from a Manet. The rest I can fudge if need be." "Then you have your whole life figured out?" "No. This is very dangerous, what we do, talking like this, eyes and ears everywhere. But not here, not in the secret garden. Mrs. Lambert saw to that." "She is an accomplished lady?" "Probably not, but perhaps real to the touch, unlike me." "You're a fraud, then." "Most of us are." You gave me an ultimatum on the beach.
Yes, I did. I did not understand it. I thought the terms crystal clear. You won't believe that I am who I am. Where is your proof?
Right before my eyes.
What is your interest in Lambert?
He's an interesting man on many levels.
You let him inside your body. You find that disgusting, don't you?
Perhaps I do. Then why allow it?
Life is full of trade-offs, she said.
What are you trading for?
On the beach, I thought it was clear.
What is your grievance?
What is yours? She countered.
He stood erect, his fingers sliding up and down the ray candle.
She said, the timing is truly remarkable, you and me.
Remarkable was not the word I was thinking of. You were thinking the timing sucked?
As you said, it can only be one of us. So you admit your intention.
Now Mako's face darkened. He had been a fool. She had drawn him in without seeming to do so. He looked around. He expected to see Lambert's security team closing in.
He looked at her, trying to discern the communication wire under her blouse or her shorts.
As though reading his mind, she said, no, Mako, it's not that way.
So you say. He turned to leave.
Will you stand down? He said nothing, but he also didn't move.
Will you stand down? She said.
Will you? He asked.
I guess I have my answer. I guess you do.
It's been a long time for us, Mako, a long time and much pain.
And you think you're alone in that?
No, but I have obligations. The end result will be to your liking.
I have obligations, too.
He walked swiftly from her, away from the secret garden that held no more secrets. Everything needed to be sped up now. The schedule, so carefully crafted, was now blown. But there was something else. Ultimatums given were usually carried out. Prices had to be paid. His rear flank had just been exposed. He was now fighting on two sides when only he had anticipated one. He looked back at her. Murdoch stood there, book in hand, staring at him. He saw many things on her features, sadness, resignation, but most of all, resolve. He turned back and kept walking. He didn't feel sadness or resignation, but he did feel resolve. The war had truly now begun.
Chapter 72.
Peter Lambert put down his binoculars but continued to watch the big man stride across the lawn and put his rake back in the landscaping truck. Lambert gauged the man's height. 6'6", perhaps a bit more. Weight near 300 pounds, perhaps, but he wasn't bulky. He was lean, but with massive shoulders and legs that revealed corded muscles through the fabric of his two small pants. An interesting fellow. Lambert had seen him talking to the maid, Beatrice, on several occasions. He had seen Christine Murdoch paying him attention as well. He was not a bad-looking man. Rugged, the ladies would undoubtedly call him. In his great size, the women appreciated such things, he knew. The old adage that big feet meant large appendages everywhere was still popular. Large feet, thought Lambert, perhaps size 16. Perhaps the same feet that had been in the flower bed outside the window of the guest house. He wondered what the man's handwriting was like. Would it match the message left on the wall of his guest house? And Lambert's men had told him of the big man, the giant, they called him, who had escaped from the oil platform by diving off into the water. He was presumed dead. What else could they presume after a dive off the platform into a dark ocean? No one could have swum all the way to land from there. Yet perhaps this man had what it took to do so, or perhaps he had help. Lambert was a risk-taker, always had been. It would be nothing to him to risk eliminating the man, even if it turned out he posed no threat at all. Collateral damage was something that did not bother him. He did not know quite what to make of Chrissy Murdoch's talking to him. He knew Winthrop didn't come close to satisfying her sexually, thus the occasional rendezvous in the greenhouse. Perhaps she liked her men giant in all respects. Perhaps it was as simple as that. Again, the question of risk. He had Stephen Roget's looking over his shoulder. No, breathing down his neck, he corrected. Such a man did not tolerate mistakes. Lambert had every incentive not to become one of those errors. He continued to watch the big man as he toiled away under the hot sun. Lambert had somewhere to go today. It was risky, but he felt he had to do. During the journey, he would decide what to do about size 16. Lambert did not know that he was... that as he was watching the man, someone was watching him. Chrissy Murdoch stood behind a tree and was peering between the branches with a small pair of binoculars she had kept in her bag. She had seen the optic signature off Lambert's device as he watched Mako. In her mind, she swiftly analyzed the situation. This actually could be good for her, allowing Lambert to wipe out her competition, for that was what she now considered Mako, her rival. She had come too far, sacrificed too much, risked everything to be in the position she was now. She had lost no one close to her to slavery in the 21st century, but it seemed that Mako had. But part of her wondered if that was truly the right thing to do, allow Mako to die, for what was she was certain Lambert was planning. She had noticed Mako outside the window of the guest house that day. If she had, Lambert could have as well. And the night the Bentley exploded, had that been Mako as well, employing some type of tactical device to either anger or frighten Lambert? If so, the tactic had failed miserably. It had done nothing to save put Lambert on higher alert. And that was saying something, because the man's alertness was always high. Maybe that blunder alone should decide it. Mako should perish. That would leave the way open for her. But the decision was not that easy. Something in Mako's eyes had stayed with her from the very first time she had seen him. He was a man who had suffered a great wound, an unseen wound, because of all the pain that was inside of him. Murdoch could understand such a thing happening in connection with a man like Peter Lambert. Lambert was perfect for what he did. He had no conscience. He cared about no one other than himself. There was no one he could not sacrifice to get his way, not his wife, not his only child. It was simply how he was wired. But you could get to a man like Lambert, hit him where it hurt. These spots were few and well hidden, but they existed. Murdoch intended to smash them all. She withdrew from the cover of the tree and walked back to the secret garden. She sat back on the bench and opened her book. Her decision was not made yet, because she couldn't make up her mind. Live or die, Mako, live or die. But there was something in his eyes, and Murdoch felt her own eyes tear up as she thought about this. Chapter 73. Pulla had phoned ahead, and Lynn and Chuck Storrow were waiting for them at their house a block off the water. It was a one-story that occupied a large part of their yard. They were ushered in by Chuck Storrow. His wife sat huddled on the couch, a shawl around her shoulders, even though it was brutally hot outside. When she looked up at them, the pain of the recent loss of their in-laws was evident on her face. Puller and Carson both expressed their condolences. Chuck said, "Please sit. Now you said you were in with the army?" Puller and Carson perched opposite the couple on a settee that was barely wide enough to contain them. "We both are," said Puller, "but I'm down here in connection with the death of my Aunt Betsy." "Oh, my God, you're John Puller, her nephew, then," said Chuck, as Lynn wiped her eyes with a tissue and looked more interested. "That's right. I understand that my aunt and the Storrows were friends." "They were," answered Lynn in a hushed voice. "Very good friends. And we knew Betsy, too, a wonderful woman. Which makes it odd that all three of them should die so close together under such suspicious circumstances," said Puller. Chuck looked confused. "But I thought Betsy's death was an accident." "The police think that might not be the case." "Why?" Puller slipped the letter from his pocket and handed it across. The Storrows read it together. Chuck looked up. "Mysterious happenings?" "At night," added Lynn. "Right, at night. Betsy died at night. She did. So did your parents, Chuck." Tears clustered around Lynn's eyes, and her husband put an arm around her shoulders. Chuck said, "I don't see what the connection might be. They were friends. Maybe they confided in each other. Maybe they all knew something about what my aunt wrote about in this letter. But surely they would have mentioned it to us." "And they didn't?" "Of course not. We would have said something." "Were you here all the time recently?" "Well, actually, we were gone for about 3 weeks, Africa, a safari. We got back and I phoned my in-laws. They didn't answer. I figured they were doing their usual beach walk. When I called the next day and they didn't answer, I started to get worried. That's when we got the police involved." "But your parents didn't try to contact you when you were out of town?" "Neither one liked to use the telephone, and they would never call long distance, even though I explained to them that calling my cell was not calling long distance. I don't think they ever quite understood that. and they were from a generation that was very frugal, and they were not into emailing or texting. Lynn gave a little sob. We should have called them. Chuck shook his head. Cell reception isn't the best over there. I figured maybe they had an accident or something. I never dreamed anyone would have. I can see that, said Poland. Did they still drive? Oh, yes, they were still quite active physically. Would they drive my aunt around? Sometimes, yes, but she could drive, too. She had her car fitted out specially with the hand controls. Right, I saw that. All these questions in that letter, do you have any idea what could have happened to them? Not really sure yet. We're just following up any lead that presents itself. Did either of them keep a journal? A journal? I don't think so. Why? Just asking. There might have been one missing from my aunt's house. So maybe if we had been here, this wouldn't have happened to them, Lynn said slowly. Sweetie, we can't beat ourselves up about that. We've been planning that safari vacation for years. You really can't blame yourself, said Carson. It's just not worth it, and they wouldn't have wanted you to. Lynn blew her nose. Puller said, your parents' attorney wasn't Griffin Mason by any chance. No, they used my attorney. Good, I think Mason will be pretty busy from now on. They rose to leave. If you find out anything about it at all, who did this? You'll be the first ones I'll tell, replied Puller firmly. Best of luck to you. God bless you, added Lynn. I think we'll need luck and blessings, muttered Puller under his breath. Puller sat in the Tahoe, but didn't start the engine. Carson looked over at him. Are we going to sit here and swelter, or are you going to turn this sucker on? Puller turned the key and the engine caught. He put it in gear and pulled away. So what did that get us? Asked Carson as she put the AC vents full blast on them. Information. Even if the Storrows had found something out, they might not have told anyone other than my aunt. You said she had put all those miles on her car, right? Puller turned to look at her as he hit the main street and sped up. Right. And you think she kept a journal? Yes. Well, maybe she found something out and told them, not the other way around. They might have been spotted or overheard, so they all had to die. Your aunt and then the Storrows. Or maybe the other way around. Or maybe simultaneously. That makes sense, said Puller. We generals sometimes do. So the oil spot we found near the sulfur pit? A truck or a car, probably. But why there? Good place to do something clandestine. Right, it stinks and you can't use the beach. But still, it would seem to be a nighttime endeavor. Yes, it would, so I guess I know what we'll be doing tonight. Yes, you do. There is something unaccounted for. There are lots of things unaccounted for. I'm talking about one in particular. The two men in the sedan who can make the Pentagon tuck its tail between its legs and run off. Exactly. That has me worried. All of it has me worried, replied Puller. Chapter 74. He could hear the sounds of large doors being raised. He didn't know exactly what the sounds represented, but they scared him. Everything and everyone here scared him. He felt a tap on his shoulder and jerked. Then he turned to face him. Diego stared at Mateo, and Mateo stared back at Diego. They were in a space about 20 feet square, and steel bars kept them there. They were more precisely lying on the floor of the cargo that had, the cage that had been their home for the last 2 days. Mateo whispered, I'm scared, Diego. Diego nodded and gripped the little boy's hand. Diego had gone to the Duinos to see if they would protect him and his cousins from the three men who had beaten Isabel and Mateo. He had taken Mateo with him because there had been no one at his aunt Zabula's home to watch the little boy, and plus Diego did not think they would harm him with Mateo there. He could not have been more wrong. What had come next had been frighteningly chaotic. Men had arrived. Something had been given to Diego and Mateo to drink. The next thing he knew, he was in this place. He didn't know where this place was or how he had gotten here. He cupped Mateo's ear with his hand and whispered back, it will be okay. It was a lie, and from the look on Mateo's face, he knew it. The light here was dim, so dim, in fact, as to make Diego queasy. Mateo had thrown up once, perhaps as an after-effect of whatever had been slipped into their drinks. They were not alone here. There were 10 cages like the one they were in, and all of them were full. In Diego's cage were 10 other people, all adults or close to it. They had segregated men from women. Diego could make out some of these shapes in the weak light. In this cage, the men and teenage boys sat on their haunches, looking at the gap between their knees, hopeless, beaten. It was exactly how Diego felt. He didn't know for sure why he and Mateo had been taken. In the back of his mind, however, he had heard the stories on the streets, takers of people. Diego never thought he would be taken. He looked over at Mateo. He was only 5, little more than a baby. Why would they take Mateo? It made no sense. A guard came by with a slender jug of water and a plate of bread and fruit. He passed them through a slot in the bars. The biggest men in the cage grabbed at the plate and jug. They drank their fill and ate what they wanted, and the leftovers were passed down. By the time the plate and jug got to Diego and Mateo, there was barely a sip of water left, a few crumbs of bread, and a wedge of apple. He gave it all to Mateo, trying to ignore the thirst in his throat and the rumble in his belly. He sat back up against the bars and stared down the line at the other cages. His gaze flitted to one that contained women. None looked older than 30. Many were teenagers. Diego couldn't understand why they had been taken. Putas, he thought. They would be worth a great deal of money. His gaze ventured upward to the high ceiling of the place where exposed air ducts and electrical lines were revealed. This was a warehouse of some kind, Diego had already deduced. But where it was, he had no idea. He had no idea if he was still in paradise or even in Florida. He thought of his Abdullah, and his eyes grew heavy with tears. He thought of Isabel, wondering where they were, and his eyes grew heavier still. Then he thought of the big man who had asked him to find the two men in the car. He seemed interested in Diego. He had helped Isabel and Mateo. He could beat people up. He was big and strong. He had driven a fancy car. Perhaps he was rich. Maybe he would come and find them. But Diego maintained this hopeful thought for barely a second. That was crazy, he told himself. The man would not come. No one would come. He looked around at the other cages again. This was obviously a big business. They were organized and had lots of money behind them. They took people and sold them all over the place. He just knew this to be true. He looked at Mateo. Would they sell them together, or would Mateo go off alone, without me? He knew Mateo would cry and cry, and maybe the takers of people would get angry and kill him to quiet him. He reached out and gripped Mateo's arm so tightly that the little boy let out a small gasp. I will never let you go, Mateo, Diego promised himself. The lights grew dimmer still. Diego looked around, fear gripping him. All the other prisoners in the cages were doing the same thing, looking around but also trying to shrink themselves so as not to draw attention. They could all sense that something was coming, and that what was coming would not be good for them. The man slowly came up the metal steps and stopped in front of the line of cages. Peter Lambert's image was not clear enough for Diego to make out who it was, but he had never seen Lambert before, so an identification would not have been possible in any case. There were other men behind Lambert. One was James Winthrop. The men were dressed elegantly in blazers, white shirts, and slacks that looked professionally tailored to their bodies. $1,000 shoes were on their feet. They could have been investment bankers going to a meeting. Winthrop held an electronic tablet and was making notes on it as Lambert inspected his product and made certain decisions. He walked up and down in front of the cages, pointing to people inside and giving instructions to Winthrop, who dutifully inputted them on the tablet. They could have been inspecting cattle in slaughterhouses or cars rolling off an assembly line. There was a clear air of business being conducted here, even though the product was human and breathing fast. Two other men came toward them. They carried packages wrapped in plastic. Lambert snapped his fingers and the men hurried forward. Lambert examined the packages and slit one open with his finger. He pulled out 4 blue shirts, looked at the list Winthrop had compiled, and pointed at 4 people in 3 different cages. The shirts were taken to these people, and they were forced to put them on. Red shirts came out and were given to all men who were larger and more muscular than the others. Green shirts were pulled out and placed on the younger, good-looking women and some of the younger, angelic-looking men and boys. All the shirts were given out except for two in a separate package. Lambert slit this package open and pulled out two yellow shirts. He glanced at Winthrop's list, running his eye down the list. Then he turned and looked up and down the row of cages until the surveillance finally came to a stop in front of Diego's cage. He looked down at the two boys and smiled. He said something to Winthrop that Diego could not completely catch, but it sounded like new product line. Then some more words were spoken he could not hear, and then he caught another snatch. Family unit, lower scrutiny, fetch a good price on the market. He gave the yellow shirts to another man, who went into the cages and forced Diego and Mateo to put them on. A few moments later, hardened evil-looking men, came through the cages and told each of the prisoners what would happen to them if they uttered one word about where they had come from once they reached their final destination. Everyone you love, every family member you have, and we know where they all are, indeed we have many of them in cages like this, will be slaughtered. If you speak one word to anyone, we will bring you their heads as a reminder of what you have done. They had looked down at Diego and Mateo and asked them if they would like to hold the severed heads of their Abdullah. Mateo had started to cry, but had instantly stopped when one of the men struck him in the mouth. Diego had stood between Mateo and the man, but the man had laughed. "Do you want your grandmother's head?" he asked again. Diego had said nothing but had shaken his head, and the man had moved on. A similar encounter had happened to all the others, demonstrating that the men had inside information on each of them. Thus, there was not one person in any of the cages, even the older, stronger men, who did not believe every word of this. None of them would talk. None of them would even think of trying to tell the truth. After this was over, Lambert came back to Diego's cage. He slipped something from his pocket and held it through the bars of the cage. As Diego focused on it, he saw that it was a necklace of some sort. "Take it," said Lambert. Diego did not move. "Take it now." In Diego's peripheral vision, a man with a gun edged forward, the muzzle of the weapon pointing at Mateo's head. Diego reached out and took it. He looked down at the disc of metal attached to the end of the chain. Lambert said, "It's a St. Christopher's medal." "You know who St. Christopher is, don't you?" Diego looked up and slowly shook his head. Lambert smiled and said, "St. Christopher is the saint who protects children from harm. Put it on. Do it now." Diego slipped the necklace over his head, and the medal came to rest on his chest. "Now nothing can harm you," said Lambert, still smiling. Winthrop snorted with laughter. Lambert turned and walked off, Winthrop behind him chortling. Diego stared at the elegant clothes hanging on their well-nourished, fit physiques. His courage came flooding back as he looked at the lion. He looked up, slowly raised his head, made a gun with his finger, aimed, fired twice, and killed both Lambert and Winthrop, over and over. This concludes the 9th episode of The Forgotten by David Baldacci. Your reader has been Chris Long.